All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised, now shifting our focus pretty much exclusively to the resource sector, down into more the equities, mostly metals, as we're chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Chat with Matt pretty much every month to get more or less a broad rundown of what he's doing with his resource-focused fund and some of the opportunities that he sees. Matt, since we are halfway through the year, you sent out the MJG partnership letter, again, when the calendar turned over in July. Let's recap how the fund is doing. I think we all understand that this is a great market for resource investors. There's a lot of sectors moving higher, but resources have been outperforming a lot of other sectors. And man, really at the tail end of H1, we did see even some of the juniors pick up steam. So just curious, in terms of the overall fund, how's it performing?
Good to be joining you, Corey. And yes, I did get out the July 2025 partnership letter. Always a labor of love. I think this one came in at 40 pages or so. But it's always nice to press send and get that distributed. It is available for anybody's consumption at the MJG Capital website at mjgcapital.com. And I'm happy to say, I mean, it was a very strong period of performance. The first half of 2025, we were up 35.77%, which is our best performing half year going back to the second half of 2020. And I'm also pleased to share that we're outperforming the S&P on both the 5 and 10 year basis. I don't have the 5 year numbers handy, but on a 10-year basis, the MJG partnership was up roughly 420% compared to 260% for the S&P. On an annualized basis, that's just shy of 18% annualized for the MJG partnership versus 13.5% or so for the S&P. So I was pleased to report that to partners. And I also made the argument in the letter's intro that the best is yet to come. I don't think anyone would really argue that it's been a, frankly, phenomenal period to be invested in large cap U.S. equities over the past 10, even 15 years. And looking back over the past 10 years, while there have been some glimmers of hope within the natural resource sphere, you know, looking back to maybe 2016, 2020 was a strong year. You know, lithium was strong in 2022. Uranium was strong in 2024. It's been a good year for precious metals. But I would argue it's been a very hit or miss decade. And, you know, as it stands, 70% of the MSCI, which is a proxy for all global equities, 70% of that is weighted towards U.S. equities. And that figure is higher than it's ever been. And the only historical period where it even came close was during the 60s, you know, during the heyday of the nifty 50 bubble. And a gentleman named Greg Jensen at Bridgewater, in a recent note, made a pretty good point, where just in order to maintain this relative weighting compared to equities globally, for every marginal dollar that is invested in stocks, 70 cents of that dollar will need to go to U.S. equities just to maintain the current weighting. And I make an argument in the letter that this is going to be difficult to sustain. Like the U.S. economy, U.S. GDP, it's only 26-27% of global GDP in nominal terms, and one point of reference. And then also the current administration in the U.S., love them or hate them, you know, they seem to be doing their darndest to really upturn the set of conditions that have really led to this point over the past 10 to 15 years. And, you know, with all that in mind, I think this bodes well for the asset classes that have largely been left behind or neglected over this past period. And you know, one more factoid for you, if you go back to 2010, net foreigners were net long U.S. financial markets by around $3 trillion. That figure is closer to $25 trillion today. So over the past 15 years, there's been a net inflow of over $20 trillion of foreign capital into United States equity markets. We don't need some huge crash in the US stock market. We only need a few, a little bit of this to look elsewhere and to diversify elsewhere for there literally to be trillions of capital, moving to other spaces. And whether that's hard assets, whether that's emerging market equities, international equities, emerging market debt, that remains to be seen. But I think it's positive really across the board for the asset classes that have really been left in the dust by the US over the past 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, Matt, something we've been talking about too, just how focused in America a lot of money has been and that potential anti-American trade that will take time to develop, but it's what we've seen this year. Other markets are outperforming the U.S. markets, even though those U.S. markets are at all-time highs. Regarding where a lot of your returns came from within the fund in the first half of this year, you have any info on that? I assume it's very precious metals focused with how good gold and then even silver stocks went, but any, I guess, insights on what allocation, what type of businesses that returned the best for you over the first half of the year?
You nailed it. You nailed it. I mean, precious metals were kind of the driving force behind the returns in the first half of the year. As of June 30th, roughly 40% of the weighted MJG portfolio was exposed to precious metals. But I should note that also includes PGMs and silver. So I think the exact breakdown is 23% of the weighted portfolio is exposed to gold, 11% to PGMs, and 6% of silver. So that's a healthy weighting. And I those names were the kind of bulk of the performance that we've seen this year. I mean, one notable standout would be Bravo Mining, which is the fund's largest position. Well, they've had some key company-specific developments over the past 4 to 5 months, one of them being an exceptional maiden resource that came out in the February timeframe. That was followed shortly thereafter by the key permit. That's the LP license, the key permit for Brazil mine development. So, partially company-driven, but also the amount of attention that the platinum and palladium prices have gotten over the past, really over the past 2 to 3 months, have certainly helped buttress the returns there for Bravo. And I guess another shout out outside of the precious metal sphere, this is a company that I've never written about publicly, but we have discussed in previous podcasts here with the KE report. Neo Performance Materials, in the rare earth space has been a big driver of performance for us as well. Last I checked, it was up well over 100% year to date. So I'd also give Neo a shout out in terms of contributing to the first half results.
So Matt, I guess now even more importantly, second half of the year, where do you see some of the best opportunities? Where are you positioning the fund?
Well, just two things are worth noting. First, we continue to have very significant weighting towards copper. I mentioned precious metals in total are at 40% of the fund, but that includes, kind of the whole gamut of PMs. Copper is our highest weighting by metal at 35% of the portfolio, I believe, as of the end of Q2. And our copper exposure has been really elevated, above 30% at least of the fund, really going back to the spring of 2024. So obviously I have a constructive view on copper. I'm comfortable with exposure to the metal. I think we have 7 of our 18 current positions are copper focused. So it's, both on a weighting basis and just a percentage of our total holdings, it's definitely a big component of the portfolio. But I really do take pains to note within the letter when I discuss our portfolio allocation that each of these copper focused names have company specific catalysts, company fundamentals, where I think value can be created independent of further increases in the copper price. Obviously, if copper continues to move, as it certainly has in COMEX terms over the past few months, that will be a useful tailwind. But whether it's with the drill bit, whether it's with potential permitting outcomes, whether it has to do with the potential for upcoming M&A, each and every one of our copper-focused positions, I see significant value that can be created purely on the company level. So that's one heavy weighting from a metal perspective. And then I'd also add our exposure to prospect generators is higher than it's ever been within the MJG portfolio. It's at 36% of our total weighting. And that figure is actually going to bump up a little bit higher. There's a prospect generator, Kincora Copper, who announced a financing early last week to great fanfare. We'll be taking a bit of that deal. That's a company that I'm excited about what they have in store over the next 12 months. So that's going to take our weighting towards the PG business model even higher. I should say, when I say prospect generators, that's kind of a broader term. And at least for the intents of the MJG portfolio, it includes traditional prospect generators or pure prospect generators. Those are groups that never drill their own properties and only will bring in partners to drill. It includes hybrid prospect generators that would encapsulate a group like Ridgeline Minerals, which is a group that I've written about for the past three or four MJG partnership letters that look to bring in partners, but on occasion will take shots on a 100% owned basis at their own assets. And that also includes royalty generators. I include as a subset into the broader prospect generator category. And I would just argue that this business model is set to return even a little bit more to favor. It's very much out of favor. It's hardly known by folks that are invested in the mining sphere. But I think it's going to benefit from a few different trends. The first is just the trickle down as folks move down market cap, you know, from the larger producers into the smaller producers, and eventually as this bull market progresses down into the expiration stage names. So that's one broader trend that will behoove these companies. The second is just the increasing need for the big boys to beef up their development pipelines. And I think we are seeing an uptick in deal volume, and I expect that to only increase. So I think there's going to be more and more interest for these groups, you know, from potential partners, assuming that the opportunities being presented by the prospect generators are large in scale. So I think scale is everything when it comes to prospect generators. And then the third point I'll just quickly note here, a lot of these prospect generators, not all of them, but a fair number of them have hidden royalty portfolios that they've accumulated over the past 5, 10, 15 years. And there have been a few examples in the past 3 or 4 years of these groups, or of a few groups monetizing these portfolios. One example would be Almadex Minerals selling its Elk Gold royalty to Star Royalties. And at the time, the you know, $10 million in proceeds that Almadex received was well more than half of their market capitalization at the time. You know, another example would be Commander Resources, who I actually wouldn't classify as a prospect generator anymore, but a couple of years ago they were. They sold their royalty portfolio to a Australian private equity group for a figure that was in excess of their current market capitalization at the time. And then another example would be Eagle Plains, who spun out their royalty portfolio into a separate vehicle called Eagle Royalties, which is now just gaining some attention because it's subject to an RTO with Summit Royalties, which is kind of a private group that's been incubated over the past couple of years. So I think there's going to be some excitement around that name. So there are a few examples, but I think there will be more examples to come of these kind of hidden royalty portfolios within some of the PGs being monetized and driving share price performance ultimately.
Well, it's really the dream for these prospect generators to offload a project or have a partner come in and then create a royalty off of that because that project moves along so well. And that's how we've seen some of these prospect generators really graduate through to being larger cap companies. Regarding your exposure to copper, certain jurisdictions that you're focused on, since it seems like everything's so U.S. focused right now, predominantly Arizona when you talk U.S. copper, are you looking more in the U.S. for copper plays, or is it a global or even a South American jurisdictional play for you?
Yeah, good question. It's pretty spread out, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the jurisdictions that come to mind would be Brazil, Namibia, the U.S., Australia, you know, entering the picture with the Kincora investment, which is a copper focused vehicle, and then Canada as well. You know, I will say there's been a huge flurry of excitement around copper in the U.S. specifically, and, you know, happy to delve deeper into that. But I will concede we've not caught that move flush. You know, the key beneficiaries of the copper tariffs, which in theory are coming into place just next month, are kind of the later stage copper development plays in the US that have the potential to make it online this decade, and crucially are able to produce cathode copper and basically bypass the smelters and sell their copper cathode directly to end users. So we do not have any investments that fall into that broader category. Our copper exposure within the United States is earlier stage and more to do with grassroots exploration or early stage of the discovery process.
All right, let's move more into some recent news out of the sector. I think pretty important news to cover. The first being MP Materials. July 10th had a key news release that announced a public-private partnership with the Department of Defense to accelerate U.S. rare earth magnet independence. And then July 15th announced Apple with a $500 million partnership to produce recycled rare earth magnets in the U.S. The stock, when that news on July 10th came out, was trading right around $30. The stock right now trading right around $60. Very interesting news, especially around that Department of Defense. Matt, take us through what you think is important here and what that could mean for the, I guess, broader magnet or rare earth sector.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on this. It's certainly exciting for the broader rare earth sector and is bringing a lot of kind of mainstream or generalist attention onto the space. Try to be concise here. I mean, I think the first point to note is there's really five different components to the DoD announcement that came out last week. The big one, of course, was the $400 million investment from the DoD into preferred shares and warrants of MP Materials. And that's equivalent to around a 15% stake in the company, you know, should all of those ultimately be converted into common shares. Second point worth noting is the $1 billion loan that was arranged by Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. And, you know, both the $400 million investment from the DoD and the loan will be going towards the construction of what they're branding their 10X facility, which in essence is a neodymium iron boron magnet facility with a production capacity of 10,000 tons per annum. In theory, that will be operational by 2028. That's what the company is guiding for. But for those with, you know, experience or understanding of the magnet space, it can take a long time for these types of facilities to actually ramp up into nameplate capacity. Third component is a 10-year offtake from the DoD, you know, four magnets from this 10X facility. So they've basically guaranteed that 100% of the magnets that are produced from this facility, once it's up and running, will find a home either with the DoD or with consumers that are, you know, brought to the fore by the DoD. And then there are a couple other components as well, unrelated to magnet manufacture. The fourth is a price floor that was put in place at $110 per kilogram, which is close to twice the going rate of, and this is for NdPr oxide. So that's an intermediate product that is produced, you know, directly from the Mountain Pass mine. So the DoD has guaranteed that for all NdPr produced by MP over the next 10 years, they'll receive a minimum of $110 per kilogram. So that's actually a really big win for the company because NdPr oxide is their primary driver of revenue and will continue to be so until this magnet facility is up and running. And then the fifth component, just quickly, is the $150 million loan to expand heavy rare earth separation capabilities at Mount Pass. So it was very much a multifaceted deal and a lot packed into a single news release. In terms of takeaways, I mean, I will say that I was quite surprised by the equity component. That would not have been on my bingo card. The price floor on the offtake, less so. That's been bandied about as, you know, potential solutions to the China problem as it pertains to rare earths for a number of years now. You know, I would say probably if I were making the decisions, probably would not have done it in this capacity. I think a better step that the US could take, and it's still one that they could take, would be to first sign an immediate mandate that all products that are bought by the federal government that contain rare earth components need to make sure that those rare earth components are sourced from non-US, sorry, non-China sources. And then also, similar to the Europeans have done, put in a mandatory quota for consumers of rare earth products, you know, OEMs come top of mind, where, you know, say X percent of rare earth consumption by X date, you know, needs to be from non-Chinese sources. And I think in the EU, that figure is 35% of all rare earth magnets that are consumed by end users need to come from non-Chinese sources by 2028. With that said, I think this is an urgent problem from a U.S. national security perspective. So I'm happy to see that some action was taken. But there are risks. I mean, the first is that this move ties the hopes of the Department of Defense to a single U.S. company, MP Materials, with virtually no magnet making experience. They are in the process of ramping up a small facility in Fort Worth, Texas. I think the capacity there is 1,000 tons per annum, but this will be their first time ever manufacturing magnets. And I mean, there are plenty of non-Chinese magnet makers out there that the DoD could have worked with otherwise. I mean, one example is NIO, Shin-Etsu, VAC come to mind, and there are 4 to 5 other names. But it seems clear to me that the government or the Defense Department in this case were intent on working, you know, directly with a U.S. company. And, you know, the final point I make is this also doesn't at all address our reliance on China for the 8, you know, heavy rare earths. Mount Pass is a big operation. By volume, it produces roughly 50% of global rare earth supply. But by nature of the geology there, it's really only has the capacity to produce 1 to 2% of global demand for two of the key heavies. And that would be terbium and dysprosium. And, you know, even with the money for the separation, heavy rare earth separation capacity there, you know, it's not going to make a huge dent in our heavy rare earth needs. So I think the next shoe to drop here would be for the DoD to go out there and throw financial support behind a project with a high concentration of heavy rare earths, most likely to be an ionic clay deposit in Brazil, to be fully candid, that, you know, a Meteoric Resources or a Clara are a couple groups that come to mind. There are 3 to 4 other potential players as well. Or alternatively, MP Materials perhaps could make a move themselves into this space and bring a new asset into the fold, one that has a much higher concentration of heavy rare earths. So sum it up, fascinating development, but I think there's more to come here if the U.S. truly wants to address its reliance on China on the rare earth front.
Yeah, those are all good points, Matt. But hey, it is good to see the government getting behind some of these projects and providing capital and even, I guess, arranging capital from Goldman and JP Morgan. Very different than what we've seen in the sector before. Any chance that this could carry over to other sectors? I hear it all the time from copper companies saying, we would love a price floor commitment. We would love the government getting behind our project and helping source funding, but it hasn't happened. So any chance that even outside of rare earths, it could happen in other resource, other metal sectors?
Yeah, I chuckle. I mean, to your point about the copper producers, I'm sure they would.
Yeah, of course they would.
I want to make a point on this front. I mean, the U.S. already produces, you know, somewhere between 55 to 60% of our copper domestically. So I think the urgency as it pertains to rare earths is a orders of magnitude higher than it pertains to copper. I mean, we're not 100% self-sufficient, but we're doing pretty well on that front. So when it comes to the copper tariffs, it looks like it's going to be 50% come August, you know, the same aggressive tariff rate that we've seen with steel and aluminum. I personally think it's misguided policy. I mean, I'm an investor, so I'm just reacting to what I see. But I think the cost of it to end users and ultimately to U.S. consumers really outweighs the benefit to increasing domestic copper supply. I mean, look, we're at roughly 60% already supplied domestically. There are two big copper smelters in production currently. There's Freeport's Miami smelter, that's in Arizona. And then there's Rio's Kennecott smelter, which I think is close to 3x the size of Miami. That's the big one. That's in Utah. But there's also a smelter that's already built that's been on care and maintenance for a number of years. That's the Hayden smelter, also known as the Sarco smelter. That's owned by Grupo Mexico, interestingly. And I'd have to imagine that is going to be fast track to production pretty quickly here. So were Hayden to come online, with the snap of the fingers, that would take domestic U.S. copper supply as a percentage of total demand to closer to 70%. And, you know, then at that point, we could fill in the gap by bringing online some of these later stage development projects that I mentioned earlier that have the potential to produce copper cathode and sell those on without the need of a smelter to an end user. I mean, if we truly wanted to go to 100% self-reliance through smelters, I ran the quick numbers last week. It looks like we need to bring on 3 Hayden-sized smelters in order to get to 100% domestically produced U.S. copper, or, you know, 1 Kennecott-sized smelter and a Hayden-sized smelter thrown in there. But I think most of that remaining 30% gap will be made up by copper cathode production domestically. And then, you know, maybe there's the chance a smelter could be built. But given the erratic nature, seemingly erratic nature of these policies, and the fact that, you know, from the start of permitting to actual production, we're talking 4 to 10 years realistically, and $1 billion plus in order to build a copper smelter of any size. Like, I think the jury's still out whether we'll see ground broken on any new smelter anytime soon.
Okay, one more story I want to quickly get to as we are running out of time here is that deal with Elemental Altus Royalties and Tether, where Tether is looking to tokenize assets. Again, this could be a move that almost brings the resource sector into the crypto sector. It's a hot topic right now, tokenized assets. But what was your takeaway from this deal? It's one of the first times we've seen crypto move into the resource sector. Now they're doing it through a royalty company.
It is super exciting. If you're trying to wrap up quickly, you asked the wrong question here, because I did a six-page write-up on the Tether Elemental deal within the latest MJG investor letter. So investors can find that in the market musing section. But try my best to be concise. I mean, I think the first point to note is that this should be thought of as a investment by Tether on their own behalf. So there's no indication that the Elemental shares that have been purchased, and Tether now owns 52% of Elemental, there's no indication that the shares will be used to back any of Tether's stablecoin offerings or other digital product offerings. Tether itself is churning out $3 to $4 billion a quarter in profit. They're in a tremendously profitable company. And I think they're looking to diversify outside of treasuries and US dollars and other, you know, US-based financial assets into hard assets. So the Tether investments vehicle that made this deal should be thought of as Tether's kind of independent investment vehicle for them to deploy some of the billions of dollars that they're bringing in per quarter. So that's point one. You know, second point to consider are, you know, what are Tether's ultimate intentions, you know, as shareholders of Elemental, as the controlling shareholders? I go through 5 possibilities, but to cut to the chase, I think it's really a combination of a couple of those. The first is that Tether, by all appearances, wants to be a long-term supportive shareholder of Elemental, allowing Elemental to grow its portfolio on a deal-by-deal basis, you know, royalty by royalty, stream by stream, you know, as Elemental has built its portfolio to date. You know, with that said, and especially with the share price bump that we've seen in the aftermath of this deal, I think Elemental's up over 50% since that deal was announced in early June. You know, if there's an opportunity for Elemental to take a run at a similarly sized junior royalty peer, I'm quite confident that Tether would be supportive of that. And then another possibility, just worth noting, I don't think there's going to be any formal co-investment agreement between Elemental and Tether. Like, I don't view this as a push by Tether to get their hands on a bunch of royalty and streams for them to own themselves. But if there's a really big but attractive acquisition opportunity for Elemental, but if they bought all of it, it would too heavily weight the portfolio to that single asset, then there's maybe the possibility for, you know, a co-investment agreement where Elemental takes half of it, Tether takes half of it and holds it themselves, and then that royalty or stream can ultimately be vended back into Elemental for shares at a later date. So that's where I think, you know, what Tether's aiming for in terms of this investment. And then the final point, broader implications. I mean, it's obviously incredibly significant for Elemental shareholders. I would argue significant. You can say quite confidently that it's significant for the shareholders of other similarly sized junior royalty players that perhaps Elemental may take a look at in the months and years ahead. in terms of broader implications, I'm pretty hesitant to draw any definitive conclusions from a single deal. But I think there is the possibility, looking back, 2 or 3 years in the future to this deal, this could be one of those signposts that kind of marks the moment where we started to see some serious non-traditional mining capital come into the space. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on, even for folks that don't own elemental shares or maybe don't own royalty companies to begin with. This could, in hindsight, prove to be quite a consequential development.
Both of these stories, the MP Materials and this Elemental Altus Royalties news, outside capital. This is something that the mining sector has been starved for as long as I've been in the sector. So all of these I find interesting and very, very encouraging, since it seems like it's early on with this other money flowing into the sector. But hey, always great points here, Matt, and always a lot of fun to chat with you. I'll post a link in the show notes on our website and podcast player to the MJG Capital website, where you can read over that partnership letter that Matt and I covered, at least some of the topics here. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and Substack page. Just search The KE Report, where you can listen to all our daily editorials, market commentary, and company updates from throughout the week. There is still so much going on in the resource sector that it is summer, but it sure hasn't died down. Matt, thanks for your time, and everyone, thanks for tuning in this weekend. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.